This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, January 15th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. Once upon a time, it was believed that racial segregation was almost purely a result of private action, redlining by banks, exclusionary covenants, and the like. Richard Rothstein, in his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, details this separation and exclusion of Black Americans' housing through explicit government policies from federal to local governments. We spoke last May.
What brought you to this specific topic?
For many years, I'd been working on issues of school achievement gaps between African-American and white children and writing about the social and economic conditions that cause low achievement. Things like poor health. African-Americans have asthma at four times the rate of white children. And if children have asthma, they're more likely to come to school drowsy or perhaps be absent because they've been up all night. And when you get a child like that, they're going to achieve at a lower level than children who are in school regularly. And if you have two groups of children who are equal in every respect, except one group has a higher absenteeism rate or a higher drowsiness rate than the other group, that first group is going to have lower average achievement.
Okay, so how does housing contribute to that problem?
Well, when you take children like that who have a variety of social and economic conditions that impede their achievement, whether it's poor health or low parental education or other conditions, and you concentrate them in single schools, it becomes virtually impossible to conceive of how those schools could achieve at the level of middle-class schools where children come to school well-prepared. Certainly good schools can do better with such children than poor schools can, but to think that these things don't have a permanent effect on the average achievement of children in those schools is silly. And the reason today that we have concentrations of those children like that in single schools and in single classrooms is because their schools are located in segregated neighborhoods.
All right. So this brings us to your book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. That's a pretty startling title. But what were the government policies? I guess if you could identify, what was the first government policy that began this process?
The most important first public policy, the major public policies that segregated America took place in the New Deal. In 1933, the Public Works Administration began building the country's first civilian public housing. At that time, of course, there was housing built by the government on army bases, but the first civilian public housing was in the Depression under the New Deal. And the federal government built this housing on a segregated basis across the country in the North, Midwest, West, as well as the South, segregating neighborhoods that had never been known segregation before. At that time, in the early 20th century, many neighborhoods in many urban areas were integrated simply because workers of different ethnicities and races had to be able to walk to their factories to work. They didn't have automobiles. There was no long-distance mass transportation, so they had to live in integrated neighborhoods. The federal government frequently demolished those integrated neighborhoods to build segregated public housing. The great American novelist, the African-American novelist and poet Langston Hughes writes in his autobiography that he grew up in an integrated Cleveland neighborhood. His best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl in high school. That neighborhood where Langston Hughes grew up was demolished by the Public Works Administration, and separate projects were built for whites and African-Americans. This was not a case of whites happening to apply to one project and blacks happening to apply to another project. These were specifically designated segregated projects, and this was done all across the country. That was one major federal program. The other major – most of the federal housing, public housing, let me say before I go on, most of the public housing at that point was for white middle-class families. African-American projects were only an afterthought. In many places, these neighborhoods were demolished and whites-only projects were built and no housing for African-Americans.
What was the public rationale? What was the rationale for structuring things in this particular way at that time?
Well, the public housing administrator, whose name was Harold Ickes, who was actually a progressive, his progressive instinct was that in building any housing for African-Americans. Most administrators would have built housing only for whites at that time. His rationale for building segregated public housing was he was going to respect the conditions that existed in neighborhoods before the housing was built. But in fact, that's not how the policy was carried out. It destroyed integrated neighborhoods, built segregated housing instead.
Help me understand what that means.
Well,
the idea was respecting the integrity
of
neighborhoods.
The idea was that if he was going to build public housing in a black neighborhood, it would only be for blacks. If he was going to build housing in a white neighborhood, it would only be for whites. But in fact, that's not the way the policy was implemented, because so many of these neighborhoods were integrated, and so segregation was created by the public housing program.
So in some ways, it was a misidentification of the makeup of neighborhoods?
I don't think it was a misidentification. I think it was an attempt to impose segregation where it hadn't previously existed. The entire New Deal was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant leadership, which we've read a lot recently about how it refused to admit refugees from Nazi Germany. So its assumptions about racial superiority were reflected in its housing programs as well.
So how does this continue then? If you had this at one time a destruction of neighborhoods that were integrated in favor of public housing that was used primarily by black Americans, presumably there were some local laws on the books that may have been punitive toward black Americans. But how do these policies continue? What was the impact, decades down the road?
Well, the public housing, as I said, was mostly for white Americans, not for African Americans. Public housing for African Americans was initially built over only as an afterthought. And the public housing was initially for middle-class white Americans. And in fact, the early public housing under the New Deal, the agencies sent out social workers to the applicants' homes to make sure that they had good furniture and their children were well-behaved and they had marriage licenses. So this was a program for middle-class people who were homeless in the Depression. And then it continued after World War II because during World War II, there was no material permitted to be used for civilian housing construction. It all was directed to the war effort. So there was a big backlog of housing. In 1949, President Truman proposed a National Housing Act to vastly expand the amount of public housing, again, primarily for whites because there was such a backlog of housing. Conservatives in Congress who wanted to defeat the public housing program, not for racial reasons, because as I say, it was mostly for whites, but because they believed that public housing was socialistic and any interference in the private market should be defeated. So they came up with the strategy in 1949 of a poison pill amendment to the National Housing Act. This was promoted by Senator Robert Taft, Mr. Conservative in the Republican Senate. The poison pill amendment was that from now on, public housing had to be integrated. And they knew that if this amendment passed, then the entire public housing bill would go down to defeat, because if they could get liberals to vote for integration and join with Republicans on this amendment, then Southern Democrats would abandon the bill in its entirety and there would be no public housing. So liberals campaigned against the integration amendment in 1949, and the integration amendment was defeated. The National Housing Act was passed with an explicit rejection of the requirement that it be integrated.
That's startling.
Well, as I say, the book is called A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And of course, this was well known at the time. It's not it wasn't a hidden history. It's a forgotten history. And as a result of the 1949 Housing Act, the mass towers that we're familiar with that have come to now stereotype public housing, vertical ghettos, were created, but again, they were created for middle-class families and separately for whites and blacks because that's what the Congress had authorized. So the most famous of these is probably the Pruitt-Igoe Towers in St. Louis. The Pruitt Towers, it was two projects. The Pruitt Towers were for African Americans. The Igoe Towers were for whites. And this happened all across the country. The separate projects built for whites and African Americans under the 1949 Housing Act as well. Well, very shortly after that, large vacancies developed in the white projects, long waiting lists in the African-American projects. The reason for this, and eventually it became so conspicuous that the public housing authorities had to open all the projects to African-Americans. Industry left the central cities. The people in public housing became poorer and poorer, fewer and fewer jobs, more unemployment, single-family, single-parent households, and so forth. The reason for the wide number of vacancies in the white projects and the long waiting lists in the black projects was another federal program begun by the Federal Housing Administration, an agency that was established in 1934 in the New Deal. Many people are familiar with the Federal Housing Administration's practice of not insuring African-American mortgages in African-American neighborhoods. That was the least of what the Federal Housing Administration did. The major program of the Federal Housing Administration was to guarantee bank loans for developers of suburbs, mass production builders of suburbs, on condition that they sell no homes to African Americans. And the entire country was suburbanized in this way in the 1940s and 1950s.
So this was a subsidized white flight?
Yes, yes. It was a subsidized white flight and a prohibition on black flight. Whites weren't fleeing African Americans. They were being subsidized to move into single-family homes in the suburbs. As a result, the African Americans became the only residents of public housing. We developed the kinds of vertical ghettos that we're talking about today. I mean, probably the best example of this, and probably most of your listeners are familiar with it, is Levittown, east of New York City. 17,000 homes built in the late 1940s. Levitt could never have assembled the capital required to build 17,000 homes for which there were no buyers on his own. He only assembled this capital with a federal guarantee of bank loans, and the federal guarantee had a condition on it that no homes be sold to African Americans and that every home had a deed that prohibited resale to African Americans. And this is the way the country was suburbanized. So you have these two interlocking programs, public housing, which was initially segregated and then became solely for low-income urban inner-city residents who were predominantly black because they were not prohibited from moving to the suburbs, and subsidized white single-family homes in the suburbs. In the 1960s, it was familiarly called by public officials a white noose that the federal government had created around central cities. And these are the two major programs that segregated metropolitan areas in a way that they never would have been segregated by private action.
What was the intent here? What you're saying seems so startling and in a way backward in how these policies were adopted. It seems very problematic. It doesn't strike me as particularly progressive in any way, shape, or form. But you know, what were the public rationales? What were the private rationales for these additional programs?
Well, as I said to you a few minutes ago, the private rationales was the assumptions of most administration officials in the 1930s and 40s was one of racial superiority and that African Americans were inferior and should be kept out of white areas. The public rationale was that if you had African Americans living in white communities, property values would fall. But that rationale was bunk because the opposite was true. Because African Americans had fewer housing choices because of private discrimination elsewhere, they actually were willing to pay more for housing than whites would pay for similar housing. So when African Americans moved to white neighborhoods, actually the property values went up. And that was true throughout the country. There were many studies demonstrating this, but the Federal Housing Administration just ignored these studies and kept on repeating this mantra that property values would fall if African Americans moved into white neighborhoods.
At what point do courts get involved here to say these kinds of programs are clearly unconstitutional?
Never. The civil rights community was almost entirely focused in this period on trying to challenge school segregation, and they devoted very little effort to challenging housing segregation. In fact, had the civil rights community made a priority of housing segregation, they would have accomplished more for school desegregation than they did by focusing on schools directly. There was one case, actually a companion case, a follow-up case, where housing was addressed by the federal courts, and that was in 1948. The Supreme Court said that courts, state courts, and federal courts could not enforce restrictive covenants by ordering the eviction of African Americans who bought homes in white neighborhoods. There were thousands and thousands, I'm not exaggerating with these numbers, thousands and thousands of cases where courts ordered the eviction of African Americans who bought homes in white neighborhoods in violation of these deed clauses. And in 1948, the Supreme Court said the courts could no longer do it.
Was this the Louisville, Kentucky case?
No, this was a St. Louis case. It was called Shelley v. Kramer, and it was a 1948 case. As a result of that case, the restrictive covenants continued, but instead of requiring the eviction of black homeowners, they assessed the penalty on white sellers that was so great as to be greater than the value of their homes. And that continued for another 5 years until 1953, when the courts finally said that these penalties also couldn't be enforced in court. But the Federal Housing Administration continued to discriminate in this way, at least until 1962, when President Kennedy finally issued an executive order prohibiting federal agencies from subsidizing segregation. But it continued, as I say, as official policy of federal agencies up until 1962. And it continued informally somewhat after that. In 1968, we passed the Fair Housing Act, and it was weakly enforced. But mostly it doesn't go on anymore today.
All right. So, you know, having segregated all these neighborhoods fairly effectively, to hear your telling of it, that has to create some sort of inertia for how these neighborhoods developed, how our attitudes about public housing have changed. Pruitt-Igoe, I'm thinking of Cabrini-Green in Chicago,
yes,
as well. So what was the social impact of having those policies set in motion and having neighborhoods effectively segregated?
Well, the effects of these policies continue today. And the reason I wrote this book is to familiarize people with this forgotten history, because we can't even begin to deal with it if we don't understand how unconstitutionally it was created. If we believe, as we do generally in this country today, that what we have is de facto segregation, segregation is simply created by private prejudice or individual choices, it's very little we can do about it, because it was created accidentally. It's hard to think of how it can be uncreated accidentally. If we understand that it was created by explicit federal policy in violation of the Constitution, then it follows that we're required to have a constitutional remedy. One of the things I say in the book is letting bygones be bygones is not a constitutional principle.
So you would argue for a policy solution to the problem that was created by the government?
Yes, we have a constitutional obligation to reverse unconstitutional policies.
I understand reversing unconstitutional policies, and you say letting bygones be bygones is not an appropriate response, but what policies could you undertake that wouldn't be equally unconstitutional in the other direction?
Well, they wouldn't be unconstitutional in the context of this history, because if we understood that we have de jure residential segregation, then things that are presently considered unconstitutional because we think it's de facto segregation would not be unconstitutional. Racial conscious remedies would be constitutional, although we don't need racially conscious remedies. We need, for example, many suburbs today, predominantly or all white suburbs, have exclusionary zoning ordinances. These are ordinances that prohibit the construction of even single-family homes on modest lot sizes, or prohibit the construction of townhouses. I'm not talking about housing for poor people. They prohibit construction of a diversity of housing types in suburbs. If we understood this history, we could abolish those or prohibit those kinds of zoning ordinances, and that would contribute somewhat to integration. Those zoning ordinances are actually fairly interesting. They were first developed in the 1920s, predominantly, in response to a Supreme Court order that prohibited communities from having explicit racial zones. And so economic zoning was designed primarily as a way around that. So it's not unreasonable to say that in the context of this history, that exclusionary zoning ordinances that were designed in many cases explicitly, in many cases implicitly, to keep out African American and other minority families should be prohibited.
Richard Rothstein is author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @Cato Podcast.